Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
Sedano with you here on 710 ESPN, presented by Progressive Insurance. All our guests appear via the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. This segment brought to us by our friends at Straight Talk Wireless. Full court cell phone coverage you need. Get the unlimited plan with 25 gigs of high-speed data and 2G for $45 a month, saving you half the cost of big carriers. Everything for less. Savings may vary. See terms and conditions at straighttalk.com. We've got Ethan Strauss, author extraordinaire, covers the Warriors for The Athletic, will join us. He's got a new book out called The Victory Machine that talks about a number of things, including how the max salary has changed the game in the NBA. Even though it was supposed to help the owners, it didn't. It helped empower the players. And it specifically talks about Durant and Curry's relationship. So we'll get into that with him. Michael Thompson will stop by. Ethan Strauss at 11. Michael Thompson before him at 10:30. I have it backwards. And then we've got our senior shout out at 11:15. Tim Kirchin at 11:30. But for the whole show, we save the best for last. Mama Momo.
What up, Georgie? How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. See, this is so interesting because I can't get in until exactly where we're about on the air because everybody else is using all the different Comrex things, right?
Right.
So I was like, I have to wait until exactly 9:55 to jump in. But I'm excited to be here. You guys are, you've just been holding it down by yourself, just like talking to yourself in your office or something? Is that what you do?
Yeah, I've got, it's 2 hours. It's nice. It's comfy. I've got Greg, and his, multiple alter egos. We have Laker boy. We have Dodger boy. We have Raider boy and Bruin boy. His four, different alter egos.
There's one thing that I need to know from Greg though. Okay. Greg, is the light on in your bedroom?
Oh,
staying in the dark.
No, I have one light on. The main light is not on. The smaller light is on, though.
Do you know that Greg is still sitting in bed right now?
Oh, yeah, of course he is. I've seen him, yes.
He sits in bed in a dark room with his laptop as the only source of light in the bedroom as he produces your show.
Yeah, no, it's insane. He's an insane person. I mean,
where else am I supposed to go? I can't go into the room.
So now that you tell me he's got alter egos, that's even weirder. It's like, is he just in the dark room all day talking to himself in the alter egos? Is that what's happening?
My alter egos are George's way of making sure that if I say anything, he can just brush it off and just say, oh, that's just Dodger boy talking.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah, I mean, there is some of that, but there's also, it allows us to talk to the different alter egos because, you know, he's corporate Greg now. And, you know, so the alter egos allows him to still be the fan without being the corporate person. You know, it's an escape. It's an out for him, in essence. Right. And then we've got Laura, who is the sanity of the program. Have you worked with Laura before?
I have. I like her very much. Yeah. I think
Hello, Laura.
I think she should get a promotion. That's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
Good morning, Laura. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you, guys. Thanks, Momo. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I gotta stick up for the ladies here.
Yeah. So I've got a crew.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, I've been binge watching The Last Dance, George.
Ooh.
They sent me the first 8 episodes. I'm working on a big story for Friday, kind of about how this whole documentary came to be. It's for those of you who don't know, ESPN is running The Last Dance, which is the 97-98 Bulls team, the last year of Michael and Scottie and Steve Kerr and Phil Jackson in Chicago. They had over 500 hours of footage from NBA Entertainment that's basically just sat in a vault for 23 years. And everyone has the agreement was Michael had control of this. So nobody could make anything with that footage until Michael Jordan was ready. And so for 23 years, it's been this sort of like, you know, holy grail of footage that every, you know, people in the industry knew about, but you really couldn't get to because Michael had to say yes. And Michael was never ready to make a documentary or didn't think enough time had passed. And so finally, about 4 years ago, this guy named Mike Tolan, who's the executive producer of this. He's a guy, he did Arliss. He's done a few of the big 30 for 30s that we've had on ESPN. He did the Inglewood Five. He's done a few, a few big ones for us. The Iverson doc for Showtime.
Right.
He convinced Michael and Michael's business associates that now is the right time to do it. And so I've watched 8 episodes, George. It is so good. It's so good. I'm so excited for everyone to watch it.
Yeah, I think it's going to be awesome because I also think the other part of it is this, is that think about it, Momo. You and I are of an age that we saw Michael Jordan in his prime. We saw Michael Jordan even when we were younger, like struggle to get to the apex, right? Like, So we're old enough to remember where he wasn't winning championships yet and he was considered a ball hog, right? Like he was considered the guy who would never win because he wasn't a team player and then became the greatest player in the sport, right? So I just think there's a whole generation or two even perhaps that have never even watched him play. So I think that it's going to be really educational, I think, for a lot of people.
It is. And I think like that was one of the ways that they got Michael to say yes, is I think in the pitch to him, the producer walked in and said, hey, every day people walk into my office wearing your shoes, but they've never seen you play.
Right.
And boy, that hits you, right? And I'll tell you this. I love seeing young Phil Jackson again. Like, like Phil with like the mustache, no goatee, just
the
mustache.
Beard.
Yeah. And he's all skinny and, young Phil. Right. And then you see Steve Kerr when he's a player, they talk about the fight with Michael. I mean, I don't want to give away too much because I want people to just watch it and enjoy it. But, one thing that was like jumping off the page at me was just, I hear so many echoes of Kobe Bryant in this. Like when I knew Kobe looked up to Michael. I knew that he watched all the videos of Michael on home video, that he emulated him. I don't think I appreciated it as much as I do watching Michael for an extended period of time. You're like, they sound the same. They talk the same. They walk the same. They shoot the same. They even celebrate the same. It's unbelievable. Like when you watch, it was just, because my frame of reference was so much getting to know Kobe, like it's just how close he and Michael really were and how much Kobe really did emulate Michael.
Yeah, it is pretty incredible when you see it. Like it is wild. Right. And there's a lot of people who grew up Kobe fans who didn't see Jordan play and will now watch it back and go, oh, as you pointed out, I get it. I get it now. You know, and that's where we're going to be.
Yeah. Plus, the more things change, the more they stay the same, right? The reason why the Bulls broke up is because Jerry Krause, who was the general manager there, kind of got into it with a lot of the main characters on the team. There was this famous quote where he said, players don't win championships, organizations do. They revisit that quote, which really caused a lot of dissension amongst Phil and Michael and Scotty and all those guys. Like, hey, whatever, GM. You know, what are you talking about? Organizations with championships. We're the players, right? And there was a dispute with Phil Jackson. Jerry Krause was just kind of over him. Jerry's daughter got married, and he invited everyone to the wedding except for Phil.
Oh.
the other guy he invited there was Tim Floyd, who would succeed Phil. So everybody knew he was coming in. I mean, it reminds me of – it's so sad that that's how their dynasty ended, but it also reminds me of the Warriors just ended for stupid reasons too.
Right.
The Shaq Kobe Lakers ended for stupid reasons too. Like when we look back on that, it's just, that's what dynasties do. It's just really hard to keep them together.
Yeah. I would agree wholeheartedly. I do have a homework assignment for you.
Okay.
Are you ready? Are you ready to engage?
Yeah.
All right. So on the poster of The Last Dance, you have Michael, obviously.
Yeah.
You got Scotty. You've got Phil, you've got Dennis Rodman, and then all the way on the left in the back, Steve Kerr, okay?
Yeah.
And now, I love me some Steve Kerr, you love you some Steve Kerr, but my guess is if you text him right now and ask him, did you think you'd be on the poster of the Last Dance documentary, he'd have something really funny to say, is my guess, because I don't think there's any chance he thought he would make the poster. But considering he's won all these titles, and I think younger people now know Steve Kerr as the coach, it was smart to put him on the poster.
Well, that's a really good point. He wasn't part of the first three championships.
No, the second three.
Yeah. He's part of the second three. So he kind of plays that John Paxson role. So John Paxson is like the shooter who, when Michael finally learns how to make his teammates better and trust his teammates, that's the big hill that he has to overcome, right? And Phil Jackson helps him do that by getting him to believe in the triangle and believe in his teammates and build them up. Like, you don't have to score everything yourself. It's a very similar transformation to what Phil did with Kobe, you know, many years later. So John Paxson is the first guy, and then Steve Kerr ends up being the second guy who he trusts to make the big shot. Neither of them are of the same kind of star power as, Michael and Scottie and Rodman and Phil, right? But
right.
I would say this. Sometimes what you do afterwards ends up making you seem more important than you were as a player, right? And, like, Steve is very humble. Like, he makes fun of himself. He's like, I really wasn't anything. Yeah. He laughs about it. But because he went and won more championships with the Spurs, then he goes and wins three as a coach with the Warriors, like, he does have a pretty big name in the game. I mean, I think Steve Kerr is probably going to be in the Hall of Fame, right? As coach, don't you think?
Yes.
All those titles. I think he's, you know, kind of the same argument you would make for Robert Horry. Robert wouldn't be in the Hall of Fame, but, like, if he did it as a coach, also he would. Yeah.
Correct. If Robert would have gone on and done something and won championships as a coach, for sure. But Steve Kerr, you're going to see in this documentary, hits one of the biggest shots in that team's run in the 1997 finals in game six. Like, he hits the monster shot. Yeah.
Yeah. And they have, you know, one thing I thought was pretty impressive about this is Michael's willing to go there. Like, there's a couple of scenes, and this episode 5 is where he talks about the Republicans buy Nikes too. It's the Harvey Gantt stuff, you know, there was a Senate race there in North Carolina. Michael goes there. Michael talks about it. I've never heard him talk about it, but he talks about it here. He talks about the gambling stuff. He talks about his father's death.
I love it.
He gets into all of it. And I was refreshed to see this wasn't just going to be, you know, a sanitized version of history. This was Michael went there.
Yeah. Well, listen, when you get the 30 for 30 people involved, you either give us the dirt nothing. All right.
That's right. I'll confess a little. So I think of my college softball team, I think I might be like the Steve Kerr. Like, I wasn't.
All right.
Like they hired at Stanford. They hired one of my former teammates to be the head coach like a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And they went and they got quote. They called me and they said, "Hey, could you give us a quote for the press release?" And I was like, "You guys know I wasn't that good, right? Like, I wasn't I wasn't an All-American. Like, you should call Jessica Mendoza. She was like 3-time All-American. Like, she's like an Olympian and stuff." And they were like, "Oh, no. You know, we'd like to have you in the press release." Like, and I'm like, okay, I understand what that's about, right? Like, I work for ESPN now. I'm in the public eye a little bit. Like, I'm a little more, I'm certainly more relevant now than I was in college when I was like batting ninth and playing right field. Okay. Like, I was like that girl. But I think, okay, just take it. Just say, okay, sure, no problem. I'll do that and I'll tweet.
Yeah, roll with it.
For you. Yeah, yeah.
Roll with it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So Steve goes with it.
Yeah, so if you can, text Steve and just see what he thinks about the poster, because I think I just think his response will be hilarious.
You want me to do it right now? All right, hold on.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. And during the break, you don't have to do it right now.
Okay.
I think it would be hilarious. All right, so let me ask you this one question. Yeah. I saw this on First Take today, because we got about 2 minutes here before the break, 2 or 3 minutes. How many more do you think they could have won had Jerry Krause not broken them up?
I know. Oh,
because let's think.
It's interesting.
Let's think.
Yeah.
Let's think. The next champion was who? It was the Spurs, right?
Yeah. So basically the Jordan Bulls, you know, leave. It's 98. Then the Spurs have their nice little run. I think those Bulls would beat the Spurs, don't you?
It would have been fascinating because they had Robinson and Duncan, right? So, like, how would the Bulls have matched up with two guys like that? That would have been the real conversation.
But who from the Spurs guards Michael? Who's from the Spurs contains Michael?
Yeah, on Spurs team, there's probably not anybody that can contain Michael or Scottie, for that matter. I'm trying to think.
Scottie would be guarding. I think Scottie would guard Duncan, and I think Rodman would guard Robinson. Right.
Right. Yeah, David Robinson would have been guarded. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry, what am I saying? I'm getting my...
Yeah, and now, what would Steve Kerr have done? Would he have stayed in Chicago? Would he have gone to San Antonio? Like, even Will Perdue, Will Perdue wasn't an all-star, but he was a role player in their center rotation for the Bulls.
Yeah. I mean, and then you think of like how history changes. So, you know, Michael wins his first championship against Magic Johnson and the Showtime Lakers. Okay.
Right.
And shortly after the Spurs dynasty fades, that's when Kobe's Laker dynasty rises. So right. would Kobe have played Michael in a finals? Like,
would Phil have never left?
Would Phil have never left?
Woo. Right. Would he have stayed in Chicago, never become a Laker? Maybe, you know, Shaq and Kobe maybe never play for Phil. Who comes in after Del Harris? There's so many questions here.
Yeah, there's so many sliding doors things here. I mean, it's NBA. You know, I even just rewatching this and putting the history together. Michael goes and plays baseball in 1994. So they win three titles in a row. Michael's just really burnt out. You know, when you win three in a row, it's just a long time. And he actually says in this documentary, he told his biographer at the time, this guy who was writing books about him and stuff, he told him in 1992, even after the second title, that he had been talking about playing baseball, that he wanted to like retire early and just walk away. He was really tired, but he felt like he needed to keep trying for the third because nobody had won three in a row. The guys that he was being measured against, so that's Magic and Bird, they'd never done the three-peat. So he wanted to come back and go for the three-peat. But he was tired. You know, he'd won in all those years where he's pushing. But then he goes 92. They do the Olympics. That's the dream team.
Yeah.
So they didn't really get a break. He comes back. They win. They win it in 93. And then that's when his father's murdered. And he had already been thinking about stepping away. His father's killed. He's devastated. And he just said, you know, he had been talking with his dad about playing baseball. His dad had already said this was a good idea. So he steps away, goes to play baseball. Terry Francona is his manager in Birmingham, right? With the Birmingham Barons. They said the reason they started him in Double A is because the facilities there were large enough to accommodate the press contingency that was going to follow him. They couldn't, anything below that, they wouldn't have had enough room to handle it. Yeah. So Terry says that he actually was pretty good. And he said if he would have stuck with it, he has no doubt he would have made the majors. But 95 comes along and it's a strike year. And Michael's a big union guy. So all the minor leaguers were being asked to cross the picket line and play and be the replacement players during the strike year. And Michael says, nope, I'm not doing it. I'm not crossing the picket line. So instead, he walks out of White Sox camp. He walks out of Birmingham's camp. And that's the end of baseball. He goes home and he's sitting at home and he gets a little itchy and he calls up BJ Armstrong and said, what are you doing? BJ says, I'm at practice. Why don't you come on by? That's how that went.
That's amazing. Crazy. That's crazy.
Anyway, you can tell I've been geeking out on this.
Yeah,
George.
Yeah. Totally we'll talk about it more throughout the show here. But coming up next, Momo, spoiler alert, the Dodgers won the World Series. I don't know if
you know
that.
Oh, my God. That was so awesome watching that last night. Ugh.
Yeah. Let's get into that in a second here. But Sedano with you here on 710 ESPN. Ramona Shelburne, Mama Momo, hanging out with us today throughout the whole show. ESPN Radio here on ESPN 710 is presented by Progressive Insurance. Quote home insurance. Man, it just got easier with Progressive's Home Quote Explorer. Quote and buy all online at progressive.com. So Michael Thompson's going to join us at 10:30. And before we get into the Dodgers, real quick, Momo, Michael's family is involved in this Jordan documentary, right?
So if there's one person to thank for this footage existing, the 500 hours of the 97-98 Bulls, it's Andy Thompson. That is the younger brother of Michael Thompson and the uncle of Clay Thompson, who was a photographer and cameraman, producer for NBA Entertainment at the time. And he came up with this idea and pitched it to the head of NBA Entertainment at the time, who was Adam Silver. Mm-hmm. And Adam Silver went to the Bulls and said, we're going to need access to the locker room, practices, whatever. And the deal they made was, you know, we just need to document this. This is history. It's probably the last year of this team. Could be Michael's last year. And we got to just get this on film. We just got to get it down and we'll figure out what to do with it later. And they talked Phil Jackson into it. They talked Jerry Reinsdorf into it. And then they talked Michael Jordan into it by saying, we'll never do anything with this unless all parties agree. And so for 23 years, all the 500 hours of footage that Andy Thompson shot, Michael Thompson's little brother, sat in a vault. No one touched it. And now finally it's making it to the screen.
Boom, it'll be here on Sunday at 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
All right. Speaking of cool footage, how awesome was it to watch the 88 World Series, game one of the 88 World Series yesterday? Now, take me back to where you were at that time. Like, forget about yesterday for a second. Take me to 1988.
Okay, 1988, I would have been 9 years old, okay? I was a little 9-year-old Momo. I was a huge baseball fan. I was a huge, huge Dodger fan. Kirk Gibson was my favorite player on that team. Although I did really like Earl Hershiser too. Everybody liked Bulldog, right? I was just watching at home with my parents. I was just watching, and I watched every single game. I was like that girl, okay? And I watched it. We were just at home. I remember Vin Scully's call like it was yesterday. I remember jumping around in my living room. Like my parents still live in the same house that I would have been at. So I remember we were in our living room watching it. And I remember when he hit the home run, I was just jumping up and down. I can put myself back there at 9 years old.
That's awesome. Yeah, awesome. It is.
Yeah.
Now watching it back was fascinating. First of all, Vin Scully and Joe Garagiola, as I mentioned, are just fantastic as a tandem. Here's the thing, like, you know, it's wild to me because people now, I mean, we were talking about Jordan, like how people don't know him now. People now who are of a certain generation have no clue that Jose Canseco was arguably the biggest star in sports, not just baseball, arguably the biggest star in sports. This is a man who dated Madonna, okay, in the 80s, all right? Like, he was as big a star as there was. He was a 40-40 guy. Like, he was in that exclusive club, and he hit a grand slam in this game. And I would imagine at that time, like, I remember watching it as an 11-year-old kid and going to myself, oh, this is over. Like, the A's were overwhelming favorites, and to watch the way it unfolded was crazy. But, think back now at, like, Canseco compared to what he is now and the way people view him now. It is just as wild a difference, as stark a difference as you could ever consider.
Yeah, he was, like, he was cool, man. It was, like, I feel like it was, like, Miami Vice or something. Like, he was, like, he just had this, like, swagger about him. Like, you know, like, Don Johnson was so cool. And he dressed in like those silk shirts and stuff. Like, that's what Canseco was like, you know? He had the silk shirts, and he was like the Bash Brothers, and him and McGuire were the Bash Brothers. And like, that was like, they were like the tough bad guys. Like, the same way that, you know, people came to see like the Pistons were like that, the tough dudes, right? Yeah. Like you couldn't beat them. Like, and I think like you look back on Canseco now, it's like he's a joke. Right. He's just like a steroid guy who like went off the rails and said all this crazy stuff. Although, by the way, everybody that Canseco outed in his book has turned out to be right.
As crazy as it sounds, Momo, he was the most credible person when it came to a performance enhancing drugs in baseball.
Right. He owned his own stuff and he outed everybody else.
Yeah.
What more can you ask for?
Yeah. So that was one thing. And then, you know, look, the A's were loaded. That Dodger team, Bergman, I thought you brought up a great point in our text chat yesterday, how Mickey Hatcher had one home run all season, but yet gave the Dodgers a 2-0 lead in that game.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mickey Hatcher was, he didn't even have a good season, period. I mean, he was just a fill-in guy. He had, listen to these numbers, 88 games, 191 at-bats, 56 hits with one home run for the entire season. That's it. That was all.
But Mickey Hatcher was like, the scrappy guy. Like, he was a fan favorite. I mean, I watched him. He was like one of my favorite players. And I remember, I just remember him being like, he still seems like he looked old then. Right. Like, when you watch that again last night, he looked old. Like, I was like, man, I remember Mickey's a coach and he looked old. Now he looks old. But anyway, but at the time, you know, watching that game last night, cause they replayed it on ESPN last night, which was like really fun to watch back. I forgot how bad Tim Belcher choked. I forgot. Oh, yeah. I mean, I was having, like, he was basically Yu Darvish. He was Yu Darvish. He just totally, he stunk in that. I was, like, screaming at Lasorda, get him out of the game. Oh, my God, he can't even find the strike zone. He's walking the pitcher. He walked Dave Stewart.
Yeah.
That was
crazy.
Could you
imagine if somebody now, like if Dave Roberts
would go nuts,
he would have killed him for that. That's not the way that baseball is played now. And I'm talking with some people.
Yeah.
Tommy Lasorda did that all the time. That was what he left guys in way too long all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the opposite of what managers do now, right? He had Tim Leary warming up. Tim Leary mm-hmm. was like ready to go. And Lasorda yeah. just was sticking with Belcher. Oh, he'll find it. He'll find it. And it's, you know, then there's other things too that just watching that back is like, just, we all know how great Vin Scully was. But to hear Vin in his prime pointing yeah. out little things like, I remember there was like Belcher was struggling and Ron Peronowski goes out to the mound. And Ron Peronowski was the longtime pitching coach before Rick Honeycutt was pitching coach. I think Honeycutt's on the team, right?
Yeah, he was.
Right? Okay. In the 88. But Ron Peronowski goes up to the mound and Vin Scully goes to Joe Gargiola and he says, he's had a problem opening up that left front shoulder. Let's, you know, they've been working with him on that. And then they show the replay of Belcher and he's like opening up that left front shoulder too soon. And you're like, wow, man, that guy was on it. Like, yeah. he, you know, one, to just know that that's what they've been working on with him. And then two, without even knowing that that replay is going to show exactly what he points out. I mean, it was like, you know, people get excited that Tony Romo calls out the plays. Tony Romo was an NFL quarterback. Like, Vin Scully is a broadcaster. So for him to point out something detailed like that and just be right about it, whew, that's
yeah,
awesome.
it was incredible. And then the other thing that stood out right before the home run that Gibson hit was mm-hmm. the graphic that went up. Yeah. That said, Dennis Eckersley has not given up a home run since August 24th. And it was just like, whoa, like that's crazy yep. that they put that up. And then two or three pitches later, boom, it's gone. And it was just, it still gave me chills to watch it as much yep. as, you know, I didn't have a rooting interest in that series as an 11-year-old right. kid, but baseball was so big back then that you were, everybody was watching the World Series. As a little kid,
yeah.
like I was living and breathing, you know, with every moment. And to watch that, like, I still got chills just like if I was an 11-year-old kid watching it.
So I have heard Vin Scully's call of Gibson's home run. I mean, Greg, how many times have you heard it? Hundreds, thousands, like, I mean.
Billions. I don't even know.
And I still get excited every time. You talk about a roll of the dice, you know, this is it, right? Like, oh, gosh. And it's not just that I know what's coming next.
In a season that's been so improbable, the impossible has happened.
And then he shuts up and you just let the moment sit there, right? And yeah. Gibson's running around and he's pumping his fist around second. And like, you can just see all the cars in the parking lot. Like, that moment is just such an amazing sports moment. And I think there's a few, like, not just in baseball, but, you know, if whatever your team is, you probably have a few moments like that when they won or whatever. But that game is so good. And then subsequently, we learned even more about this, right? Is, you know, the reason why Gibson kind of knew that was coming, that pitch was coming, is there's a scout named Mel Didier who had said that when Gibson gets ahead and he's 0-2, when he gets ahead of you, he comes with the backdoor slider. I mean, that was
Eckersley.
Straight up.
Eckersley gets
ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah. When he gets ahead 0-2, when he gets you down, he tries to get you out with that backdoor slider. So that was in the scouting report from Mel Didier. Gibson knew it. It was 0-2. He knew to sit on the pitch. And he just threw his hands out at it. I mean, it doesn't even look like a good swing. Like, when you get it again, it's like a terrible swing.
Yeah,
awful. He's just throwing his hands.
Yeah, it's crazy. All right, speaking of crazy, Michael Thompson stops by. He's going to come by to gloat. We'll talk to him about a number of things. Momo's hanging out. Sedano, 710 ESPN. Sedano with you here on 710 ESPN. Mama Momo hanging out today. Ramona Shelburne with us for the whole show. Michael Thompson going to join us here in a second. It's all presented by Progressive Insurance, and all our guests appear via the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. It's time for Straight Talk, brought to you by Straight Talk Wireless. Everything for less. Only at Walmart. Michael, hope you and yours are safe and healthy since the last time we spoke. We're bringing you on to gloat. Do you know that? Did you know that we were bringing you on to gloat?
I gloat even if I don't have nothing to gloat about. What are you talking about?
Well, Greg and I were talking about how Christian McCaffrey yesterday became the highest paid running back in NFL history. And I talked about how you and Key would go at it about Christian McCaffrey when I was doing the mornings. And you are victorious. He is not only the best running back in the league, but he's the highest paid of all time. And you basically called it. You said he would be the guy.
You know, I hate to say it, and I'm not accusing Key. I'm not talking about Key, but I'm talking about a lot of other people who were evaluating McCaffrey when he was at Stanford. He suffered from reverse racism because we have not seen yep. a running back like him do what he can do in the NFL since probably the 70s. So A lot of people thought that what he was doing in college wouldn't translate to the NFL because does he have speed? Can he juke guys in the NFL? I said, if he's doing it in the Pac-12 against NFL caliber defenders, he'll be able to do it in the NFL too. But a lot of scouts didn't want to believe what they were seeing because some of them didn't think because of his pigmentation he would be this successful in the NFL. We may as well just face facts, guys.
Well, look, I mean, you don't have to tell me, man. That's my guy. That's a Stanford kid, right? And
right.
I can't believe he didn't win a Heisman. Like, when you, like, he was so good in college. And, you know, you just couldn't he was never going to get the respect he deserved. Stanford running backs have a history of kind of, like, coming up short in Heisman votes. But he was kind of hurt, I think, in a way by the failure of other Stanford running backs. So, like, Toby Gerhart was a big guy for us, right? And he didn't really do much in the NFL. So I think, like, McCaffrey comes along. He's awesome. But he was, like, kind of put into that same category as Gerhart, which is, like, okay, really good college guy. Maybe he's a system thing. Maybe it's because Stanford has good quarterbacks. Like, maybe it's just, you know, whatever. They run the ball a lot or the way they use him. I just don't think he got the respect in college just for one, as you say, Michael, I think it was a little reverse racism. I also think it was just like, you know, the recent history hadn't gone as well for Stanford running backs in the NFL.
Yeah, that's true. You can look at it that way, talk about recent history, but you've had other running backs come out of programs that didn't really have any big running position, but they get drafted high because they see how skilled they are when they perform on Saturdays, and they didn't hold that. The school passed against the other three guys. So, Christian McCaffrey was just doubted because they didn't think what he was doing could translate to the NFL because of one main reason. I mean, we may as well not going to sugarcoat it.
Michael,
look back on that Heisman vote, George. He lost to Derrick Henry, who was at Alabama that year. McCaffrey finished second, and Deshaun Watson finished third. That was a pretty good Heisman year, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Baker Mayfield is fourth that year.
Let's get Michael on to call back, or let's call Michael back so we can get him on a better connection, because it might just be that he's just on a bad connection because he kind of keeps getting garbled and coming in and out. Look, I mean, McCaffrey, you could have made the case for him, but those years there were some pretty good guys that won the Heisman. Yeah. So look, it's relatively competitive, and I just think he's being utilized in a way we haven't seen really since Marshall Faulk, you know, where he's catching the ball like 100 times a season or something like that. And by the way, you mentioned Lamar Jackson. When I get Michael back, I'm going to let him gloat about that too, because he called the Lamar Jackson too. I'll say this.
Yeah.
Michael may not be a great NBA GM, but he sure as hell can be an NFL GM at this point.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I think his main point, though, always is just if you're doing it at the college level and it's like no joke the way you're doing it, it's not just a gimmicky system quarterback, right? Like, that should translate to the NFL. It should. I mean, now the problem is there's been so many great college quarterbacks, like, you know, Johnny Manziel was a great college quarterback, and people draft him way too high and it just doesn't translate. But that was a kind of a gimmicky offense he was running at Texas Tech.
Oh, there's no doubt.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So, Michael, not only we were talking about, you know, McCaffrey winning the Heisman, but Momo pointed it out. Those 2 years, Derrick Henry won for Alabama. And then your other boy, Lamar Jackson, your guy. This is another guy that you tabbed from day one. So go gloat about him, too.
Well, what frustrated me about Lamar and the scout report is he couldn't throw. And I watched all of his Louisville game, and I've seen him put passes right on the money on receivers at full stride. And I kept saying, what do you mean he can't throw for 3,000 and something yards? He must be connected somewhere. So that's what frustrated me mostly starting on Lamar, the doubts about him is throwing abilities when I saw him make passes from every kind of sort of the NFL quarterbacks he makes. So that's what frustrated me about him.
Yeah. I mean, we even had people saying he should have converted positions, right?
Like, right.
He was supposed to, hey, they should make him a wide receiver. Make him a running back.
Yeah, okay. That happened on our show. It was me and Keyshawn and LZ. It was, what's his name? Bill Polian came on the show and said it right there. And we were like, what? so it was pretty crazy. Michael, let me ask you this. Momo and I were talking about The Last Dance, and you didn't tell any of us, at least I didn't know, that younger brother was involved in this Last Dance Michael Jordan documentary.
Was involved, basically, is the producer.
Yeah. Right.
It was his filming, and was as major a producer of this film as anyone. And boy, just told me some stories. I can't reveal them here about behind the scenes what was going on with the Bulls back then. I mean, we'll tell you, we'll talk about it off the air, but there's some juicy stuff. And even though they got some juicy stuff on camera, this is the greatest sports documentary in history. I don't think this my brother did it. What he was describing about what's on this thing, 22 years, I think, it's been in the can to be released. This is going to be amazing to watch.
Mm. Yeah, I talked to your brother, by the way, Michael. Did he tell you?
No, he didn't tell me to call him. What did he say?
I know, because it's
hard to get away from your probing questions.
I know, right? Yeah, no, we talked for probably 30, 40 minutes. I'm doing a story for this week, you know, just to set up the documentary. And I was just kind of wondering how he got in with Michael Jordan, right? Because he shot a few of his home video things. And he told me a story. I don't know if he's ever told you this, okay? But apparently, Andy was working with Ahmad Rashad, right? Andy Thompson, your brother, was working with Ahmad Rashad on NBA Entertainment. Ahmad was really close with Michael, and he decided, and they went out, they were going out to dinner. So he invited Andy along. This is how he met Michael. And Ahmad says, Andy is Michael Thompson's younger brother. And Michael Jordan says to your brother, I love Michael Thompson. I think it's so cool that he changed the spelling of his first name. I tried to do that too. Okay. When he was coming up, but his mom got mad and she wouldn't allow it. And that's why he liked your brother and kind of let him into that circle of trust. Did he ever tell you that story?
No, I never heard of that.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, how about that? He's the second greatest Michael that ever played the game.
Oh.
I mean, look at that. Michael Jordan wanted to be like you, Michael Thompson. Instead of be like Mike, it should have been be like you, Mike.
I tell you, that's right. And, you know, the thing about Michael Jordan is, you know, today, Ramona and George, as you guys know, you guys are around these NBA stars all the time, these legends. And when they go out, they usually have – with them. I'll never forget this. I went to dinner with me, Andy, my brother, Michael Jordan, and Trent Tucker, the former Nick. The four of us went out to dinner, sat in a restaurant, no bodyguards, no nothing. I'm sitting there with Michael Jordan, then the most famous, probably the greatest athlete in the world. Nobody bothered us. We were just sitting there having a good conversation in the middle of a restaurant. He didn't need any bodyguards or entourage around him keeping people away. I was so cool.
Yeah. So your brother is basically the creator, the idea guy behind this, and the voice that we hear in a lot of the interviews that were shot during that year. But so he takes all these hours and hours of video, and he says at the end of the year, when Michael hits the shot at the end, they scores 45 in the last game, they win the championship, The Last Dance. He said, I knew we had just shot the greatest sports documentary ever. And then it basically sat in a vault for 20 years.
Right. And now, guys, even say anything with LeBron around, and what the documentary won't be released for several years until LeBron retires. So several years from now, we're going to get one of these about LeBron, and that's going to be so cool. And the thing about my brother is, I remember I used to smoke cigars, and my friends would look at me with disgust. You smoke them nasty things, right? But after hanging around with Michael Jordan and Lamar Rashad, he became a fish officer too.
Oh, that's funny. That is funny. Michael, last one before we let you go, because your phone's crapping out on you, but I wanted to ask you this, because you played against them in a finals at the beginning, and at the end, you know, Michael in his 30s, they broke up. Obviously, this was the last dance that your brother documented. How many more do you think they would have won? Could they have beaten that Spurs team in 99?
They would have won. I would have broke the Bulls up a year, so they should have one more chance.
Right, wait, we can't hear him.
Jordan would have had 7 rings instead of 6.
I think he said they would have won. I'm pretty sure
they would have won 7. Right, one more. I caught the end of that. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time. Get a better phone connection next time. Come on.
I'm out here on my yacht.
He's out here on his yacht. I got that.
Yeah.
He's out here on his yacht. I got it.
All right, Michael. See you later. Thank you so much. Don't I speak garbled cell?
Yeah, like, you know, does your son, is he talking a lot yet? Or is he doing a lot of like half words and stuff, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I have to like decode my son's language all the time. So we say, can you say please? And he'll be like, puh. I'm like, okay. He says more. So I can decode that.
All right, coming up next, you and I can compare notes. And also, Clayton Kershaw drew a line in the sand, Momo, on this Arizona thing. We talked about it a little bit yesterday. I want to get your thoughts on that. We'll get to that in a few seconds. Stick around. We're back in 2.5 minutes. Sedano, 710 ESPN. Sedano with you here on 710 ESPN. Momo hanging out with us today. We're happy to have her, as always. Brought to you by My Computer Career, training for a better life. And if you miss any one of our interviews today, Ethan Strauss is coming up at 11, Tim Kirkchin at 11:30. And in between that, we will have our senior shout-out, Evan Leonard from UCI Men's Basketball. Another Irvinian, another anteater. And again, check out our entire interview on demand section for the Sedano Show podcast, brought to you by the Capital One Quicksilver Card, earning unlimited 1.5% cash back on every purchase everywhere. What's in your wallet? And we've been talking about The Last Dance. When it comes to insurance, State Farm's the real deal. With over 19,000 local agents and an award-winning mobile app, you can get the help that you need when you need it. Find an agent, get a quote at statefarm.com. And The Last Dance will air every Sunday from 6 to 8. Alan Sliwa and I will have a video recap on the ESPN Los Angeles Twitter account from 8 to 8:30. So make sure you tune into that on ESPN Los Angeles' Twitter account. So Momo, real quick, before we get into Clayton Kershaw, because Ethan Strauss is coming up in a couple minutes, you and I have young toddlers, basically the same age. We're at 18 months and change. You're at...
Yeah, 18 months. I think you're literally a week ahead of me. So I'm like,
yeah. Oh, that's what it was. It was a week, right? It was a week or so. So, so we can compare notes. A lot of screaming. And I don't know about you, but really nasty poop.
Oh, mine's not that bad. I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm just over it. I'm over that. Like I did that this morning. Cause I was doing your show at 10. So I had the morning shift. I had the early, you know, went from whenever he wakes up. So as soon as he wakes up, because he sleeps, you know, 10 or 11 hours, and then he wakes up, I mean, you know, that diaper's loaded, right?
Yeah.
So you know what you're getting in the morning, right?
Oh,
you know, like, it's that thing's full. And I don't know, I'm just kind of over it. It's okay, you know? It's like, oh, it is what it is. Like, you know, we just... But it's also my first kid, so maybe like, second kid, you're like...
yeah, yeah. You're like, come on. Well,
and
you could also compare.
Happy for him. Yeah, I'm kind of happy for him. I'm like, okay, good. Get that out of the way. You know, it's actually when the diaper's not loaded in the morning that you're like, we're gonna be a little fussy, you know, until that happens.
The advantage of having an older one is that you can at least tell her, hey, keep a quick eye on him for a second, right? Like you can, even at five, it allows you a minute or two for the most part where you can have someone else watch while you're grabbing something. You know what I mean?
Totally.
So it's nice to have that, that little help on our side.
And also we're at a very cute stage right now where he's really into reading books with me. And I'm not just saying that because I do the first five California. Okay, he loves reading
us
books.
Too.
Yeah. So so he comes and he sits like, I'll sit like cross-legged and he'll come sit on my leg and I'll read the book to him like probably seven times in a row. So his favorite books these days are I Am a Mouse and I'm a Kitten. And we read those over and over and over. It's really fun.
That's awesome.
He also
has a
book with trucks. He likes the truck book.
Yeah.
And when but he doesn't say any of the trucks. So he opens up the truck book. And as soon as he turns the page and he gets to the one with like the tractor, he's like, "Woo!" That's my favorite.
We're at a stage before we get to Clayton Kershaw where he is now a climber, and he'll jump on the arm. He'll get onto the arm of the couch and then he'll dive onto the couch. And I'm like, dude, there's going to be a broken arm in your future here. You're going to fall off this couch at some point.
Daniel has been climbing on the footrest, but the chair in his nursery. Probably, I mean, I think since before he was a year old. I mean, he was climbing on the thing early. And now he knows how to climb on it and then jump from the footrest onto the chair. And he gets to almost the top of the chair and he's like trying to like launch himself off of it. And I'm like, oh my God, you're crazy, kid. I'm here
it's
to catch
very
you.
Wrestling. Woo. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's very wrestling off the top rope, right?
That's what it feels like.
But
Yep.
Good Lord. All right, so let's get to Clayton Kershaw here real quick. So Kershaw, I know that Wright Thompson's got a great story on Clayton Kershaw and how you know, look, this could be the last great season for him potentially, right? And we're dealing with a pandemic, which is just wild.
Yeah.
But Clayton Kershaw yesterday told Sportsnet LA he's not doing this Arizona thing. Like, he's not interested in being away for 4.5 months. And I took the position, Momo, that I get it. I am not bemoaning him for feeling that way. But if the sport decides to go and they get the green light and they want to do it without Clayton Kershaw, then so be it. Like, that's just the reality. And we all are adults and we all have to make decisions. But I think the sport will move on with or without him or their stars if they're not all willing to do it.
Yeah, I think it's really hard because, you know, the players are going to have to be in this bubble, which is not going to be very fun. Right. Like it's really going to be hard to control it. I would think that surprises me about Arizona because, you know, they're used to doing that in spring training. I mean, Ellen and the kids just, you know, he has three kids under three, I think. They live in Arizona with him. I mean, she would just stay there. It's like, I think you'd be able to see your families, right? Is that how it would work? Or would they sequester?
Well, I think they're stuck in the hotel. Yes. They're sequestered in the hotel.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I get that because I feel like I would have the same conversation too. Like, I don't know if I, you know, if they said the NBA's season is restarting and the only way you're going to be allowed to cover it is if you live in a hotel for 2 months. I don't know that I could do that. Like, not see my family and kid for two whole months, like not even on an off day. That'd be pretty rough. I mean, you kind of have to do what you, at some point, like in our jobs and our situation, you do have to do what the job calls for at some point. But, but those are pretty extreme measures. I mean, that's almost like being a astronaut going off into space for a big long mission.
Sure. I mean, I said it yesterday. That's the position. Basically, exactly what you said yesterday is what I said. This is the job I signed up for. And if I've got to do sidelines for, you know, whatever it is, 2 months or whatever they need me to do, this is the job I signed up for. And that's the reality of the job, you know?
Yeah. And it's, I don't know. I mean, it's going to be an interesting question when we all get back to this, whenever that is, whether it's, you know, in July or August. I don't, you know, I kind of am taking the Adam Silver point of view, which is that none of us know what the world's going to look like in a month. So instead of trying to predict it, let's just kind of roll with it and be in the moment. And, you know, you talk about what it would take to be okay with this. I noticed something in baseball yesterday that I thought was going to be really important. 10,000 players and coaches have signed up to be part of this antibody study. And it's kind of like one of the largest group of not just players and coaches, like players, coaches, team employees, everybody who just like works.
Yeah, concession workers.
Yeah, yeah. So the reason why that's important is because it's not just sorry, you can hear Daniel screaming in the background. He's okay.
Oh,
everyone.
It's okay. Come on.
He's just eating breakfast. And this is what 18-month-old
he's just being
boys
a 18-month-old. Right, exactly.
They have to text and have everything okay in there? when you, it's because when they do these antibody studies, you want to have the best cross section of people that you can. You want to have a real diverse cross section. So you don't want to just have players. You don't want to just have coaches. You want to have team employees, concession workers, et cetera, so that you have a real comprehensive slice of a population, right? Of a group of people. And I think it's really important, you know, that they're doing that. It also, though, gets around some of the political ramifications of sports teams, leagues, et cetera, having more access to testing than the general public. And I think that, if, you know, in the NBA, if they were to do, let's say, the bubble thing, you know, like go to Vegas or go to whatever, maybe there's an Eastern Conference bubble and a Western Conference bubble, I don't know. If they were to do the bubble thing, everyone would have to be tested and there would have to, you know, I don't know how many tests is that, 20,000, something like, you know, I mean,
yeah.
And how could you justify using all those tests for just so we can have sports, right? Like there's that sort of social and political question, and it's really a moral question too. But if you did it in service of science, where you're part of a large scale antibody testing thing, I think you could probably sell that. I think you could probably do that. So I don't know if everybody noted that story yesterday, but that seems pretty important to me.
Yeah, it is. It is. And Mayor Garcetti and Governor Newsom have basically said similar things about just real quick on a news perspective, as far as large-scale crowds in California and particularly here in L.A. with Mayor Garcetti. Don't expect it until 2021 is basically the point. So make sure you you keep that in mind as things are going. But sports could be back. We will talk to Ethan Strauss next. He's got a book called The Victory Machine about basically the Warriors dynasty and how it broke up and really how LeBron was the impetus to a lot of this and how player movement and player empowerment has kind of changed the game. We'll get to all that with Ethan next.